Kirtijana Prado Rajanavir. So, word by word. Vritta. Known very well. Anuragam. Popularity. Apura Prakriti. Among all the citizens and government officers. Janapada, desiring to serve the people in general. Raja, the king. Navi. Atmajam, his son. Samaya Setu Rakshayam, to protect the people strictly according to the Vedic principles of religious life. Abhisitya, enthroning. Brahmaneshu, to the learned Brahmanas. Upanidaya, entrusting. Saha, with. Merudevya, his wife. Merudevi. Vashalayam, in Bhadarik Ashram. Prasanna Nipunena, performed with great sacrifice and expertise. Tapasya, by austerities and penances. Samadhi Yogena, by full samadhi. Nara Narayana Akyam, named Nara Narayana. Bhagavantam, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Vasudevam, Krishna. Upasina, worshipping. Kalena, in due course of time. Tat Mahimanam, his glorious abode in the spiritual world. Vaikuntha. Avapa, achieved. Thank you very much. The translation by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. King Nabi understood that his son, Rishabhdev, was very popular among the citizens and among government officers and ministers. Understanding the popularity of his son, Maharaj Nabi enthroned him as the emperor of the world to give protection to the general populace in terms of the Vedic religious system. To do this, he entrusted him into the hands of learned Brahmanas who would guide him in administering the government. Then Maharaj Nabi and his wife Meru Devi went to Bhadarik Ashram in the Himalayan mountains, where the king engaged himself very expertly in austerities and penances with great jubilation. In full samadhi, he worshipped the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Nara Narayana, who is Krishna in his plenary expansion. By doing so, in course of time, Maharaj Nabi was elevated to the spiritual world known as Vaikuntha. So, the purport. A little bit long, not too bad. When Maharaj Nabi saw that his son Rishabhdev was popular with the general populace and the government servants, he chose to install him on the imperial throne. In addition, he wanted to entrust his sons into the hands of the learned Brahmanas. This means that a monarch was supposed to govern strictly according to Vedic principles under the guidance of the learned Brahmanas who could advise him according to the standard Vedic scriptures like Manu Smriti and other shastras. It is the duty of the king to rule citizens according to Vedic principles. According to Vedic principles, society is divided into four categories: Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra. Chatur Vanyam Maya Shishtam Guna Prama Vibhavasha. After dividing society in this way, it is the king's duty to see that everyone executes Vedic principles according to his caste. A Brahmana must perform the duty of a Brahmana without cheating the public. It is not that one attains the name of a Brahmana without the qualifications. It is the king's duty to see that everyone engages in his occupational duty according to Vedic principles. In addition, retirement at the end of life is compulsory. Maharaj Nabi, although still a king, retired from family life and went with his wife to a place called Badaryakaksham in the Himalayas, where the deity Nara Narayana is worshipped. The words Prasanna Nipunina Kapasha indicate that the king accepted all kinds of austerity very expertly and jubilantly. He did not at all mind leaving his comfortable home life, although he was the emperor. Despite undergoing severe austerities and penances, he felt very pleased at Badaryakaksham, and he did everything there expertly. In this way, being fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness, Samadhi Yoga, always thinking of Krishna, Vasudeva, Maharaja Nabi attained success at the end of his life and was promoted to the spiritual world, Vaikuntha. This is the way of Vedic life. One must stop the process of repeated birth and death and return home, back to Godhead. The word Tan Mahimanam Avapa are significant in this regard. Srila Sridhar Swami says that Mahima means liberation in this life. We should act in such a way in this life that after giving up this body, we will become liberated from the bondage of repeated birth and death. This is called Jivan Mukti. Srila Viragava Acharya states that in the Chandogya Upanishad, there are eight symptoms of a Jivan Mukta, a person who is already liberated, even when living in this body. The first symptom of one so liberated is that he is freed from all sinful activity, apahata papa. As long as one is under the clutches of Maya and the material energy, one has to engage in sinful activity. Bhagavad Gita describes such people as Duskrina, which indicates that they are always engaged in sinful activity. One who is liberated in this life does not commit any sinful activities. Sinful activities involve illicit sex, meat eating, intoxication, and gambling. Another symptom of a liberated person is vijara, which indicates that he is not subject to the miseries of old age. Another symptom is vimritu. A liberated person prepares himself in such a way that he does not take on any more material bodies, which are destined to die. In other words, he does not fall down again to repeat birth and death. Another symptom is vishoka, which indicates that he is callous to material distress and happiness. Another is vijihatsa, which indicates that he no longer desires material enjoyment. Another symptom is apipata, which means that he has no desire other than to engage in devotional service of Krishna, his dear most pursuable Lord. A further symptom is satyakama, which indicates that all his desires are directed to the Supreme Lord Krishna. He does not want anything else. He is satya sankalpa. Whatever he desires is fulfilled by the grace of Krishna. First of all, he does not desire anything for his material benefit, and secondly, if he desires anything at all, he simply desires to serve the Supreme Lord. That desire is fulfilled by the Lord's grace. This is called Satya Sankalpa. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti points out that the word Mahima means returning to the spiritual world, back home, back to Vaikuntha. Sri Sukadev says that the word Mahima means that the devotee attains the qualities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is called Sad Dharma, or the same quality. Just as Krishna is never born and never dies, his devotees who return to Godhead never die and never take birth within the material world. Did he read the verse back and have everybody repeat yesterday? King Nabi understood that his son Rishabhdev was very popular among the citizens and among government officers and ministers. Understanding the popularity of his son, Maharaj Nabi enthroned him as the emperor of the world to give protection to the general populace in terms of the Vedic religious system. To do this, he entrusted him into the hands of learned brahmanas who would guide him in administering the government. Then Maharaj Nabi and his wife Mero Devi went to Badarikashram in the Himalayan mountains, where the king engaged himself very expertly in austerities and penances with great jubilation. In full samadhi, he worshipped the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayana, who is Krishna in his plenary expansions. By doing so, in course of time, Maharaj Nabi was elevated to the spiritual world known as Vaikuntha. Om Magyan Timurandasya Vinana Shakalaya Chaktum Militam Vina Tasme Sri Dhrave Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Sri Gadadhar Srivasati Gaurabhakta Vrinda Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharane Nirvisesha Sunyavadi Paskacha Desatarane Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Panchakalpa Tiruvyascha Kripa Sindhuvayevyascha Patitanam Bhavanevam Vyo Vishnavevyo Namo Namaha. Hare Krishna. So I can admit that I am intimidated to sit here in front of all of you and at the side of my spiritual master. But Srila Prabhupada ordered each and every one of us to go out and preach, and that preaching isn't limited outside the gates of our temples. He also meant we must speak to each other and encourage each other. So I'm begging you to please encourage me, and hopefully you might hear something that encourages you. One thing I will begin by saying, in the purport, Prabhupada begins to mention the Varnashram system, and I am not going to be even going into that topic because it's not, at this point in time, a defined topic other than the basic definitions, but within ISKCON it's kind of a very, which you might say, a hot topic because there's different groups and factions of devotees who have their idea what it may be, should be, could be, and So the discussions are not always in harmony with each other. So until the devotees get together and the GVC gets together and we can have kind of a common understanding, I prefer to just acknowledge that Prabhupada did want us to implement a Varnashram system. He did say that around the time of his departure that now 50% of his work was done and there was 50% more to be accomplished, naming the Varnashram system. And I'll leave that for persons who are more enlightened to discuss. But still there is a gradual awakening and awareness within our society to be thinking about this topic and discussing it. And Varnashram is dependent really on Krishna, and Krishna, he, by his own example, was taking care of cows. So at the base of the Varnashram, there are the cows. And more devotees are becoming aware that cow production just is not limited to the goshala where you, you know, pay a few rupees and you give some ladus or some grass and pat the cow on the head. That, you know, the care of the cows is intrinsic. And this care of the cows must actually be a very visible and integral part of our Krishna consciousness movement. So there was have been many discussions. Jai Sri Sri Gornitai, Sri Sri Krishna Bhagavan, Sri Sri Radhe Rama Dikrishaka, Jai. So it has been discussed just in January at the National Congress of Leaders in North America. A very wonderful presentation was given by Tukaram Prabhu, who was here yesterday. If I don't know if he's here today. Oh, so if you have more questions about this topic, here's a very learned brahmana who presented very wonderful insights, which now in front of him, I will just make a couple points. How he, and then again at the GBC meeting, there was a half day, or 1.5 hour session just for this topic of, it's a newly coined phrase, I think, Ahimsa milk is, I don't think it's actually found in the Shastra, but Ahimsa milk means milk produced without violence. And then there was a shorter presentation called The Other Milky Way, which meant milk coming from the poor cows that are really part of the commercial industry. And Tukaram Prabhu was explaining to us that of course, we don't eat meat, fish, and eggs. We understand that, you know, by following these principles, we are automatically vegetarian. Not that we proclaim ourselves, we are vegetarian. Prabhupada said, actually, we're not vegetarian, we're Krishnatarian. He told us if Krishna ate meat, we would also eat meat. But Krishna doesn't eat meat, and he loves the cows. And how can you accept something from your mother and then turn around and kill her? It's an impossible situation. So Tukaram Prabhu was explaining that even though we don't eat meat, if we think about the process of the commercial dairy industry, and this is not limited to the West. India is a big, big proponent in the commercial areas of using cows in their parts. So if you are taking milk from the commercial dairy, it means the cows are not being protected. And as soon as the cow does not give a sufficient quantity of milk, in other words, just like in Sankirtan, we have a quota, so many books. Well, in the commercial dairy industry, the cow has a quota, so many pounds of milk, so many liters of milk. And when the cow falls short, she is no longer valuable. She is no more commercially viable. And she is taken away to the slaughterhouse. So it is a very painful situation. And what can we do? This is an issue. What can we do? We have to do something. Prabhupada asked us to do something. He asked us to establish cow protection. And that means from the beginning to the end. And to create an awareness for all people of the need of protecting our mother cow. So by taking this commercial dairy product, even though it is not our intention, we find ourselves in the very uncomfortable position of being part of the very nasty commercial business which ends in slaughter. So it is, for us, a very, you know, deep consideration. And how can we avoid this? And that's where the cow protection, the goshalas, come. And in Tukaram's case, he lives in a temple. It's not, he's a temple president, he's a GBC deputy. He has a temple that, it's not in a big city, but it's not a country village, and it's along the side of the ocean, and the ocean itself doesn't, you know, it's not a place where you can put cows. But feeling so deeply about this subject, his temple has purchased land that is good land to raise cows, and they have their own little farm. It is the temple farm, their temple, they worship Panchatattva. So Panchatattva has their own little farm, and Panchatattva is worshipped with milk received from these protected cows. In America, we have Gita Nagari Farm, it's in Pennsylvania. But around Pennsylvania, you have New York, you have New Jersey, and other places. So this farm in Pennsylvania, Gita Nagari, which was one of the second earliest farms, New Vrindavan being the first, it has begun producing on one way, it is a commercial level, but it's a commercial level in a spiritual intention to serve Krishna and the devotees of Krishna and to serve the deities of Krishna in the temples. So it's risky because, you know, suddenly they had just a few cows and then they bought a whole herd of milking cows. But there is so much desire to serve Prabhupada like this, and then to supply the temples, the nearby temples, with this wonderful ahimsa milk obtained by protecting cows that will never ever be put to slaughter. New Vrindavan in the past couple of years has really woken up. You know, there's always been a goshala there, there's always been the cows. But actually, the residents of New Vrindavan, and I'm putting myself in this, although I'm not so much there, but I'm one of them, we wouldn't be so interactive with the cows. Somebody else was taking care of the cows. And, you know, every once in a while we would hear, oh, a new calf was born, and we might go over and see the new calf. Sometimes we'd hear one of the older cows was dying, and we may go over and chant. But we didn't go over and shovel the cow poop, which has to be done to keep the cow place. We didn't brush the cows. We weren't milking the cows, not on a regular basis. But now we're understanding that it is our duty, it is our obligation. We are living there in New Vrindavan, which Prabhupada said is non-different from Vrindavan. And what is Vrindavan? The land of Lord Krishna. And what is Krishna? This means, who are Krishna's dearest friends? We're the cows. So we are realizing in New Vrindavan that we have an obligation to be part of protecting the cows. And it's having wonderful results. Devotees are coming forward and milking the cows and brushing the cows and assisting the couple who are, there is a married couple who are serving the cows. Lady Lalita Gopi, she has a perfect name, Gopi, and her husband Ananda Vidya. Ananda Vidya used to be a top book distributor for his entire life. He was brahmachari, distributing Prabhupada's books. He knows Srimad Bhagavad Gita entirely by heart. You can tell him any verse, any chapter, and he will recite to you not only the Sanskrit, word by word, and the whole purport. He knows Srimad Bhagavatam so well. And he understood these cows are very important. So he went from books to cows. Actually, he still does books on occasion. But he's milking cows, he's making butter, he's making ghee, he's making yogurt. And he even helped with the delivery of a little bull very recently. And he was so ecstatic that Krishna has given him this opportunity to serve him in this way. So it is a topic that can't be casually discussed, and nor can it be kind of talked about in a few minutes or even a couple of hours. But it's something to think about. that when you go back home, many of you are not living in Vrindavan, when you go back home, to please think about where does the milk come from in your temple, and is there any way you might follow the example that Tukaram and others, there are other temples that are attempting this, to have your own small farm somewhere outside your city and engage the devotees practically in serving the cow and protecting the cow. And I hope, Tukaram, is there anything you want to correct with? Yeah, thank you. So, speed along here, that Maharaj Nabi, it's mentioned that he went to Bhadrik Ashram. So this Bhadrik Ashram is mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam in the third canto, and he says that it says there, it's in the fourth chapter, that there in Bhadrik Ashram, the Supreme Being Vishnu, in his incarnation as the sages Nara and Narayan, has been undergoing great penances since time immemorial for the welfare of all living beings. So that is very wonderful, that for the welfare of all living beings, the Supreme Lord in his plenary expansion is undergoing penances. Srila Prabhupada also had this mood of welfare, of bringing welfare to all living beings. And it was one of the primary reasons that he established the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. When he established ISKCON in July of 1967, he gave seven principles or seven purposes of ISKCON. And one of the purposes was that to systematically propagate spiritual knowledge to the society at large. So he wasn't just thinking about us, the ISKCON members, but society at large, and educate all people in the teachings of spiritual life in order to check the imbalances of values of life. Don't we see things are a little out of whack this day and age, that things just don't match up? So it's imbalances of life, to check the imbalance of life and to achieve real peace and real unity. And some of you may remember this one little pamphlet, this one little booklet called The Peace Formula that Srila Prabhupada wrote. If you haven't read that, you can kind of look it up, you can probably find it on the internet. But Srila Prabhupada was interested in the welfare of all living beings, not just the few of us that are gathered here today. So then he went, the Maharaj Nabi, he went to Bhadrik Ashram and he began to worship Narayan Rishi. And in the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam, in the 8th chapter, there is a little history of the appearance of Narayan Rishi. So Sanaka Goswami was speaking to Sita Goswami, and he told him that Markandeya Rishi was, he was speaking about Markandeya Rishi, who was the only survivor to exist following the devastation at the end of Brahma's day. So, I mean, it was a pretty intense situation because he was in this ocean of devastation, just himself being tossed relentlessly by the waves. And during that time that he was in this ocean of devastation, he saw this beautiful, bright, effulgent young child on a folded banana leaf, sucking his toe. Very unusual situation. So, Markandeya had received brahminical initiation, and he was prepared for this initiation by his father. And during the time he studied the Vedic hymns, he was very strict in his life. He observed the regulative principles. He became advanced. It's explained he became advanced in austerity and Vedic knowledge. And he was a lifelong celibate. So he worshipped also the Lord in a daily basis, and he worshipped him in five ways that he regularly worshipped the Lord in five forms. So the forms were that the sacrificial fire, the sun, his guru, and I'm not sure who his guru is, I don't know if you know. So I couldn't find it either. The Brahmanas and the Super Soul. So daily he was worshiping these five. And then by worshiping the Supreme Lord for countless millenniums, it said actually countless millions of years, he conquered the unconquerable. So what is the unconquerable? Death. So, I mean, very amazing. So at the time of the devastation, he was not devastated. So he lived through six periods of Manu. He was passing through six periods of Manu. And then he was in the seventh period of Manu. And Lord Indra, who we know is sometimes challenging, you know, sometimes he can display behavior that's a little bit creative and somewhat inimical. He saw that this great sage, Markandeya, was very, very mystically powerful. And Indra felt threatened because King of Heaven, is there somebody more powerful for me? And he decided he wanted to impede. He wanted to break this yogic samadhi, this transcendental trance. So what he did was, you know, one of the things he does is he tries to engage others in non-devotional service sometimes. So he sent Cupid, along with celestial singers, the apsaras, dancing girls. He sent spring season. We're enjoying that spring season now. He sent sandalwood-scented breezes and and he sent greed and intoxication personified. So all of these were deployed to Bhadrika Ashram, and Markandeya was totally absorbed in trance. His ashram, his hermitage, it was kind of like an echo village in that there was no, you know, gross development. Everything was sattvic. There was the brahmanas, there was beautiful birds, flocks of beautiful birds sweetly singing. There was cuckoos and dancing peacocks. There was other sages who were also absorbed in the Vedic mantras. So into this situation, first Cupid sent spring. Spent the spring breeze. So the spring breeze is very freshly scented, and it was entering the ashram, and it was carrying sprays of water that came from the nearby waterfalls. And then he sent the fragrance of spring flowers. So we all can appreciate the very sweetly scented spring flowers, you know, and it, sometimes it's, you know, makes you feeling a little dizzy-like. And then he sent in, you know, some of his other servants, the dancing girls, these singers, and he invoked the lusty spirit of Cupid. So then he came and he stood there, and there's this crazy scene going on. There is Cupid with his bow. His bow is made of sugar cane, and the string is made of humming bees. And he has a five-flowered arrow. And the five-flowered arrow is from the Ashok tree, blue and white lotuses, from jasmine flowers and mango tree flowers. So he's standing there watching all this. And Markandeya remained totally undisturbed. He wasn't even aware of that these girls were dancing in provocative manners, and some of the apsaras were singing so sweetly. And then this one apsara, Pujikastali, she started to put on the full throttle. She was, had these little balls. Somehow we read quite often that when some lady wants to seduce somebody in the old days, they would play with, you know, juggle with balls. So she's playing with these balls, and she's running around while she's doing it. So her hair and the flowers in her hair, they became a little disheveled, and her belt around her waist became a little loosened, and then a breeze came along, and it just whoosh, wiped away all of her clothes. So she was standing in the four directions only on. She had nothing on. And now Cupid thought, aha, now I've got him. And he pulls this flowered bow, bow and one of the flowered arrows, and he let loose, and nothing happened. There was no disturbance by Markandeya Rishi. So slowly, I mean, you can imagine this crazy scene, the dancing, the singing, and the behavior going on. And, you know, Cupid strikes. I mean, Cupid's bow has brought down quite a few mighty men. You know, he even got in the case of Lord Shiva once. Actually, as a result of that, Lord Shiva was so upset that he shot him a glance and burned him to ashes. And then there was Cupid, a pile of ashes. And then, you know, Parvati is always very kind to the, you know, persons who are in some kind of distress or, you know, maybe get a zap from her husband. And he could understand, well, Parvati's a little agitated. What's wrong? What should I do? And she asked him, well, please, this isn't right. Maybe you could reform him. So then he was reformed as a breeze. So at any rate, slowly this whole scene was kind of winding down. The madness was going on. And they realized Cupid struck the bow and nothing's happened. And the sage is just sitting there with full absorption and meditation, and we're acting like fools, like children who've been asleep and are just waking up. They started to slowly realize what was going on, but they couldn't understand it. And Lord Indra was completely shocked. You know, how could this be? This whole scene, and Cupid and that sage is totally undisturbed. I mean, Markandeya did not succumb to false ego. I mean, some of us might sometimes we're taking the darshan and somebody, you know, how the little human bulldozers come along and shove you aside and push you, and, you know, sometimes you're a little annoyed. Markandeya, not disturbed. So the Supreme Lord, to show his mercy on Markandeya for being such a great saint, Markandeya had fixed his mind in self-realization through penance, Vedic study, and observance of the regulative principles. And from this, you know, he had developed great, great spiritual strength. So the Lord appeared personally before him in the form of Nara Narayan. So one was bluish, one was blackish. They had four arms, so two of the arms were up. They had a chakra and a conch. And then the other two arms were in his lap. He was in a yoga mudra pose. And then they carried a mendicant's pot. They had a straight bamboo danda. And they had prayer beads made out of lotus seeds. And they were carrying this durba grass, bundles of durba grass, and that durba grass is symbolizing the Vedas. And they were very tall, and they had the effulgence, it said, of radiant lightning. So they were described as austerity personified, and they were being worshipped by the forest demigods. So Markandeya began to experienced symptoms of ecstatic ecstasy, trembling on the skin, you know, the hair standing on end. And he immediately stood up, which is the right thing to do to receive them, but he also fell down full of dandavat obeisances, and he was just in a choked voice full of ecstasy, was saying, please accept my humble obeisances. I offer my humble obeisances. I offer my humble obeisances. I offer my humble obeisances. And then he began beautiful prayers of gratitude and glorification of the Supreme Lord in the form of Nara Narayan Rishi. Very, you know, wonderful scene, and Maharaj Nabi went there in this ecstatic, it was a very noble thing, and it was the right thing to do for a person of his stature and his age. That we are not meant to hold on to any role, any position. Some people like to remind the GBC members about this point. And at a certain point, one has to give up their circumstance, the material circumstance, that mixed circumstance, and fully dedicate the rest of their life to the service of the Supreme Lord. So not only did King Navi give up his wonderful kingdom and his throne and installed his son, just as Ramchandra was at a young age installed by his father on the throne, well, almost, but the desire was there. Because, why? The citizens loved him, and it was time for him to retire. So here it's pointing out that the citizens loved his son, Markandeya. Rishabhdev. They loved him, and he was a pious person. So then the king, in the right way, to give up his throne over to his son, and over to the brahmanas who could properly guide him in his new activities as the emperor. And Nabi and his wife went and fully immersed themselves. And it said that in immersing himself in this devotional service and serving Narayan, he was jubilant. He was undergoing severe austerities. We can only imagine what those austerities are, because Badrik Ashram, it's over 10,000 feet in elevation. Quite high up in the mountains. And you can imagine that during certain seasons, specifically from November to April, it is very cold there. But he was indifferent to the material circumstance, in full absorption in yoga samadhi to the Supreme Lord. So that is an example that is given to us from this wonderful pastime. And Krishna Prabhupada finishes the purport with, just as Krishna is never born and never dies, his devotees who return to Godhead never die and never take birth in this material world. So this is a great gift that we've been given by Srila Prabhupada, an opportunity to engage in pure devotional service, that service which is without material desire or material inebriations, to simply engage in Krishna's service and somehow check the imbalances in our own life, what to speak of the world, and come to the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, lover of the cows. So thank you very much. Hare Krishna. We have 5 minutes here. If anybody has any, would you like to say something? Yeah. You speak.
I'll ask you a question at the mic.
You ask me a question. Oh my God. You'll see me go out that door very fast.
It may be slightly off topic, but I was wondering if you spent time in Vrindavan in the late 60s and 70s. If you spent time in Vrindavan, you had any realizations or any special experiences you'd like to share if you spent time with Prabhupada?
Prabhupada didn't bring us here until 70, 71. So in the late 60s, we weren't, the ISKCON wasn't arrived in India yet. I was in that first batch of devotees who came in 70, in the fall of 70, early fall. And we were simply following Prabhupada. He said he invited us to come. There was 11 of us, the 11th one being my small daughter, Saraswati, who was personally invited by Prabhupada. He, on the letter, he put Ann, baby Saraswati. He gave a list of names, Ann, baby Saraswati. And there were a few devotees already here. And Prabhupada invited us to come to the world. He wanted us to begin the world Sankirtan party. So the first at least 9 months, we were